You're listening to the Radio Book Club on Community Radio KGNU. It's a monthly collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, and my co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian, who is the head buyer at the bookstore. And this month, a local pick, a mystery set in a fictitious northern Colorado town, a suburb near Fort Collins. Tell us more.
This month's pick is Girl in Snow by Danya Kukovka. And it's set up probably close to Fort Collins, where Danya grew up, from what I understand. We can get into that later. And it's at the foothills of the mountain, but it feels interchangeable. It could be, you know, Broomfield or Louisville or, you know, something outside of Longmont. But it definitely has a Colorado feel. But it's a fictitious town. It's not Fort Collins or any of the particular cities that we have.
Well, Girl in Snow is the title of the book. And Danya Kukovka, welcome to the book club.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what compelled you to write this story? It's a story where book opens and there's been a teenage girl who's been murdered, and then you see how different people react in the town. What compelled you to tell that kind of story?
So I'm from Fort Collins. So I started this book when I was 19. I was a sophomore at NYU, and I had moved to New York about 2 years earlier, but I was still very much in a Colorado mindset, and I had grown up here and felt very attached to the landscape. So that's why it's set in Colorado. And the general idea for the book that I had came when I read a book that really inspired this one. It's called The Virgin Suicides by Jeffrey Eugenides. And I was so interested in how that book plays with perspective and voyeurism. And I sort of thought, what if you have this small community where a tragedy has occurred? If you have this character, the book started with the character of Cameron, who's arguably the main character of the book for me. And I sort of thought, if you have this character, Cameron, who lives in a small town and disaster happens, how can I make all of his flaws as a character still sympathetic? So can you believe that he has done something, maybe like murdered one of his classmates, and still love him as a reader? And that was how I thought of the idea for the book. It's a little dark, but
yeah. All right. Well, you talk about different perspectives. Jeffrey Eugenides' book, I think, was told by the we, right? Mm-hmm. It was the first person plural, which is a pretty strange perspective. You don't do that, but you have three different people. You have Cameron, who you're just talking about, who kind of stalked the victim. You have Jade, who's sort of a family friend who has come to hate her over the years. And then you have Russ, who's a police officer who has a connection with Cameron's family. He was the partner of Lee's of Cameron's father on the police force. How did you come about these three points of view? And there's different perspectives. You tell Jade's story is first person, and Cameron and Russ's stories are not first person.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the writing of this book was actually quite circular for me. I probably wouldn't do it this way again, but I started writing Cameron's perspective first, and I began this book thinking that it was only Cameron's story. So I wrote an entire draft of Cameron, from the beginning to the end, just his point of view. And I got to the end, and it didn't really work. And I thought there was something missing. I knew there was something missing. And I basically had the plot figured out, and I had written a short story for a class at NYU, and that character from the short story was a very early version of Jade, and it had been well received in the class, and I sort of thought, what if I add this character into the novel? And so Jade came after I had a full draft of Cameron's book, and I wrote her chapters and wove them in through what was already there of Cameron's. Mm-hmm. So it was a long and maybe tedious process, but it allowed me to stay in one character's head as I was writing. So I got to really be with Cameron as I was writing his perspective, and then really with Jade as I was writing her perspective. And then Russ came along after that. So I thought I had written a young adult novel because these characters are teenagers. And I signed with my literary agent, and she said, I don't think this is young adult. I think this is for adults, and it's also very short. And I think we can add an adult perspective and really push it into the adult, you know, thriller mystery realm. So I thought up Russ then. And at that point, I had a full polished draft of a novel that was just Cameron and Jade. And once Russ came in, I did the same thing as I had done with Jade for Russ. So I wrote all of his sections and then just inserted them into what I already had. And that opened up the story so much for me.
Well, Russ is somewhat tangentially connected. Mm-hmm. like I said, he was the partner of Cameron's father on the police force, where Jade and Cameron are more, they have more scenes together. They're both teenagers. Mm-hmm. They're in the same neighborhood. And Russ is kind of a different perspective in the town. And so you felt like maybe you were opening up in the wet sense that here's how an adult in the town, like he's representing yes. more than just himself in that sense.
Exactly. And he gave me the opportunity to really dive into the police investigation, first of all. So I was able to add more of the mystery elements that I wanted to add once I added Russ. And he also is an adult, and these other characters are teenagers. They don't actually know what's going on. They think they know everything, but they live in their heads. They're 15 and 17, you know? And so it was really nice to have an adult who was grounded and knew things about the world to be able to sort of guide the reader outside of the teenagers' perspectives.
What about Lucinda Hayes? Because it opens mm-hmm. with Lucinda Hayes is dead. She's been found dead. And then it launches into how all the different characters experience that death and then their past relationships with her, and then this mystery, you know, evolves and we figure out who eventually who is the person who murdered her. But where did she come from? Was she kind of an add-in at the end? It was like, oh well, we need someone to be dead here, so no. Lucinda, you're it.
No, Lucinda was the start of the story for me. So Lucinda's interesting for me because I'm not that curious about who she is. I'm much more curious about how the other characters project themselves onto her, who they think she is, who they want her to be. And that's really what the book is about to me. It's not really about the inner life she lived, because I don't even know the inner life she lived. In a certain sense, she is just a body on a playground, and in the end we find out who did it. But I was careful to stay on the periphery of that central event and really explore how her death affected people rather than her life itself.
And you really do that, and certainly the three characters, Cameron, Jade and Rust, you get right into the inner workings mm-hmm. of them. And certainly the teenagers, Cameron and Jade, I mean, full mm-hmm. of teenage angst, both misfits in many ways. And you learn a little bit more about Lucinda depending on who you're reading, because mm-hmm. everyone had their own idea of who she was and their own experiences as well. Was that difficult then to not flush her out a little bit more and to keep her as that, I don't know what the term would be, but keep her as that element that people project onto her?
Yeah, she's almost like a mirror, right? So she's transforms into whatever these characters hope for her to be. You know, Jade wants someone to hate, Cameron wants someone to love, and Russ wants to do his job, which is to figure out who killed her. And beyond that, she doesn't really have her own world. And that was difficult for me, but at the same time, it actually made it easier because I didn't have to know her. And I thought it was really interesting for me to watch her exist like at a distance. She was always at a distance for me.
Well, we see her at a distance through Cameron. Cameron goes out in the evenings, sneaks out of his house, and he basically stands outside of Lucinda's house as a watcher. And he sees her in the house, in the bedroom, watching TV or whatever she does, going through her night routine. He calls them statue nights, I believe. Mm-hmm. Somehow it doesn't come off as creepy. I mean, it's somewhat creepy, but you realize that Cameron doesn't really mean her ill will. And it seems like Lucinda, who actually does know he's there, doesn't feel he means her any ill will either. Yet she doesn't try to befriend him really in any way.
Right. I hoped to keep it sort of vague whether she actually knows he's there or whether Cameron has imagined that she knows he's there. I like to think she knew that he was standing out there and sort of felt that he was protecting her, even in the end when he couldn't protect her. He's pretty creepy.
Yeah, well, then you get the extra layer that I really enjoyed. I think the Jade passages for me were the most visceral in a way. And I think that's because, well, they're first person and they're also present. Mm-hmm. So she's pushing. You're in the moment with her all the time. But she's watching him watch her, because her bedroom, her window overlooks Lucinda's house, and she can see him there too. So she's a voyeur in her way too.
Exactly. And, you know, Jade is a little bit jealous because she, you know, every 17-year-old girl wants to be, I mean, not necessarily watched through the window by a creepy guy on the lawn, but attention and adoration, right? And Cameron has that for Lucinda, and she's able to watch it from a distance and sort of imagine it into her own life.
We're speaking with author Dania Kukafka today on the Radio Book Club on KGNU. Her first book is Girl in Snow, and it is in one way a murder mystery because it opens with the finding of Lucinda Hayes, a teenage girl. Her body is found, and then we figure out ultimately by the end of the novel who has killed her. But it really intersects three different characters: Cameron and Jade, two teenagers, and a cop, Russ. And it is set in 2005. Why 2005?
That was very intentional. I think that Facebook, and specifically Facebook, but all social media, has changed the process of grief in a lot of ways. It has become much more public. And I think if Lucinda had died when Facebook existed, her death would have looked very different than it would have in 2005, right? The book is very much about perception, about what we see about other people versus what we think we know versus what is actually true. And now that social media exists, we're allowed to show the sides of us that we want to show. And in 2005, there were, you know, blogs, there were photos, of course, there were plenty of ways to express yourself, but none of it has changed voyeurism, I think. And I really wanted to talk about that purer state.
And I think it's changed the teenage experience in
Absolutely.
Ways that I can't even imagine.
Me neither.
Between Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and that voyeurism. In one way, you're putting yourself out there and you're not hiding things to the world. It's all, you know, here's my image. But in many ways, you can also creep around on people's social media profiles and observe them from afar instead of standing outside looking in their window. And I kept thinking, why don't these people have curtains? Everyone's looking at their windows. And nobody has any curtains, it seems.
No,
no. Well, you know, I stayed at a vacation house in Canada, and there was absolutely no curtains anywhere in the entire house. And I guess we just lived up there. I mean, I think that's becoming more of a style, too. But people don't necessarily think it's dark out, and you leave your windows, your curtains open, and then it gets dark out, and you don't maybe close them until you go to bed at night.
Yeah.
And
I suppose you don't imagine there's somebody out there watching you.
Right. Well, I mean, the sort of idea for the watching came from, I'm from Fort Collins, and I've lived in many different houses in Fort Collins, and most of them have been on, like, cul-de-sacs, smaller suburban streets where you can see into everyone else's houses. And having moved between so many houses where you can see into everyone else's houses, I sort of started thinking about it, you know, what are the lives that we can visibly see versus what those lives actually are.
You know, it's interesting hearing you talk about moving in different mm-hmm. houses and the suburban experience, because, you know, the in the book, the town of Broomsville is not discussed in a positive light a lot of times. It's all beige houses, or it's like a Monopoly board, or it's, you know, it's just the same over and over again, these same neighborhoods. And at one point, I think Jade says it's boring people living their boring lives. So, you know, the frustration of being a teenager in that setting, it seems like, is a big part of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I moved to New York right after high school, and I come back, and it's always so interesting to me to be back in the neighborhoods that I grew up in, because there is that sense, I think, in suburban landscapes where you're very much in the community that you live in. And some people, and you can feel like there's no way out, but it's not always in a bad way, of course. And someone said to me, you know, this book isn't really an ad for Colorado. And I was like, what do you mean? I love Colorado. But I do see what they mean. I think there's a certain sense of being a teenager and just wanting to escape your life that has manifested in the landscape of the novel.
Well, I thought it was a comment a little bit on the ugly sprawl. I mean,
yes.
Colorado is a beautiful, beautiful place, and the foothills are beautiful. But what's happened in the last 20 years here isn't beautiful. It's like everywhere else. It's like when I go visit my sister in New Jersey,
right,
and I see the neighborhoods that have grown up, and you look at what's happened between Boulder and Denver, and that's what you see, and
right,
that's what these kids see.
Yeah.
And for them, they're not living the beautiful Colorado.
Exactly. And a lot of people are surprised by this, you know, people who live on the East Coast and come to visit, and they don't expect it to be a suburban sprawl in the way that it is. So I wanted to portray that truthfully.
And then the time of year, it's set in February, and mm-hmm. so you always have this kind of chill, it's cold. Given how much time Cameron spends outside watching in people's houses, was that a deliberate thing to have it in winter? I mean, was that weather, that time of year, the light that you have in winter as well. Was that all part of what you wanted to really convey?
Yes, definitely. I think February particularly is a stir crazy time for a lot of people. You know, you feel kind of pent up. You just want to get out of winter. And I also found just as a writer that my tendency is always to write in summer. And someone pointed out to me that all of my flashbacks took place in the summer. So I better set the book in winter.
Well, you tell a lot of the story through the flashbacks. Mm-hmm. I think the most prominent story you tell is that of Cameron's father, Lee. Lee was Russ's partner, and Russ really looked up to and befriended Lee. And then Lee does something hideous, and he basically runs away. You know, he's accused of a crime, he's found innocent, and he runs away. And he runs out of Russ's life as much as he runs out of Cameron's life. And I felt the father, the story had a theme I thought of, like, absent fathers. Mm-hmm. And especially with Cameron's father literally being absent, but Jade, who is abused by her mother, her father does nothing.
Yeah. So in talking about Lee, I really wanted to talk about genetics. I wanted to talk about the fact that, you know, you have to come to terms with that fact that you're your parents' child. Everybody has to do that. And then what if your parent has done something awful? Both of my parents have not done anything awful, by the way. My dad is very present and lovely. but I think it was an interesting examination of Cameron's psyche for me to look into how he sees his father in himself. And so that is why Lee was the character that he was. And then to have Jade's father absent while she is, you know, physically abused by her mother allowed her to be a hero in some senses. So, you know, she protects her sister. She stands up to her mother sometimes. And in those moments, she's able to feel powerful. She didn't have anyone coming to save her. So she had to save herself. And I wanted to give her that power.
He's so absent, she doesn't even call him dad. I mean, he's there.
Yeah.
She just calls him Terry.
Terry, yeah. And I think at one point she describes him as like a old Labrador.
He's like a benign presence in the house. He just doesn't get involved. There were smacks of Columbine, the school shooting in there, because Cameron is kind of identified early on by another character, a friend of the dead girl, Lucinda, as being someone who could bring a gun to school. And then that triggers a whole series of events where the school counselor gets involved. And that's very much in the shadow of Columbine. You were in school when Columbine happened. I mean, do you remember that and the impact? Okay.
Yeah.
But did that loom large over your school experience in terms of, for outsiders and for teenagers who maybe in years gone by would have just been, oh, they're the weirdos, but now people are paying more attention and then maybe mislabeling people as potentially dangerous.
Absolutely. I think there is much more of a conscious danger now after Columbine. But it is interesting being in 2017 and talking about this book, which is set in 2005, which is not that far away from Columbine, and since the gun control problem has gotten much more escalated. I think Columbine looms large over everything, especially in Colorado.
I thought it was interesting that the three teenagers at the heart of the story, if you count Lucinda, Jade, and Cameron, they're all living hidden lives. You know, their parents, there's really not adults who know what's going on with them. Lucinda's leading this hidden life that'll eventually lead to her murder. Cameron goes out at night, and his mother at one point says, well, I kind of knew you went out, but I thought it wasn't anything harmful. I chose not to worry. Mm-hmm. I chose not to worry. And Jade's parents have no idea what she's going through. And I think it's interesting that these teenagers in this day and age, or 12 years ago, are able to live these hidden lives. It seems like we hear a lot in the media about helicopter parenting and people getting overly involved. And you've got a book here where there are still spaces where teenagers carve out for themselves in good ways and bad ways.
Yeah, and I imagine that even with helicopter parents, teens are living internal lives that their parents have no idea about. Whether they can actually do anything is a different question, but, you know, every teenager has a pocket of angst that sometimes manifests in action, but not always.
We're speaking with author Danya Kukafka today on the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Her first book is Girl in Snow, and it is set in Colorado. It's a fictional suburban town close to Fort Collins, which is where Danya grew up. Do you want to read a little bit to give our listeners a sense?
Yeah, why don't you read a piece from Cameron to start. And Cameron is the one who you tell him in the third person. So he's not using his voice, the I.
Right. Correct. And this is a passage where he is thinking about Lucinda, the girl who has died. Cameron had not chosen Lucinda. She was simply brighter than anyone else. And Cameron's collections, Lucinda had planted them and they'd grown and made him better. He liked her tan body and her ski jump nose, and Lucinda had that pull, like she'd unraveled his intestines, tied them to her bedpost, and was tugging him back there, constantly, inch by painstaking inch. Lucinda kept a figurine balanced carefully on her nightstand, and Cameron had loved to watch them together. A ballerina in a purple tutu, with one leg stretched in an arabesque, a term Cameron knew from Mom. The ballerina wore a pink V-necked leotard, her blonde hair pulled into a tight ceramic bun. She had pinprick red lips and was no bigger than Cameron's hand, palm to pinky if he flexed. Lucinda would sit with the figurine before she went to sleep, like she was daring the ballerina to move. Cameron loved to watch them during his statue nights. The little dancer stood guard over Lucinda as she slept, a toy version of the girl, graceful, slender, so controlled. The easy elegance of this dance.
Well, you know, the line that I underlined in that passage was, like, she'd unraveled his intestines, tied them to her bedpost, and was tugging him back there constantly, inch by painstaking inch. I mean, that is quite the image. And I guess if you thought of, I guess you, in some ways you almost see Cameron, rather than being some perpetrator by being like a peeping Tom or a voyeur, you almost see he's a victim of his own obsession there. I mean, who wants to have their intestines tied to a bedpost?
No. Even as I was reading that, I was like, oof, that is pretty angsty. But I really see his love for Lucinda as a tragic love. And that is at the heart of this book. And I think that brings us to a greater conversation about good and evil, right? About whether he is good because he has these obsessions and maybe perversions. And if you can call that love.
Well, you have a character we haven't talked about in the book who's very obsessed with good and evil, and that's Ivan.
Mm-hmm.
And Ivan is Russ's brother-in-law. And Ivan is an immigrant from Mexico who gets involved in a drug deal. And he doesn't think there really is evil. And that really sets Russ off. Maybe you can talk about that and how you just, you know, go back and forth between those two on good and evil and how that colors the whole book in a way.
Yeah. So Ivan was one of the most interesting characters for me to write. He is intellectually much more there than Russ is. And I think in a lot of ways, Russ has the power in the situation. Russ is a cop. Ivan has been to prison. He's an undocumented immigrant. And Ivan has this emotional capacity and intellectual capacity that Russ could never even dream of. And in that way, he has the power. And for him to be able to talk about good and evil in the way that he does, I think there's a line where Ivan says, there's no such thing as evil. You know, I've been in prison and I've talked to some of the worst people, and people are always trying to do good. Not always, but if you do something evil, you have to reckon with it somehow, right? And Ivan gave me the opportunity to say that aloud. And I had been exploring that idea with Cameron for the entire book, and it was really great to have Ivan as a vehicle to sort of really explicitly say what I wanted to.
But Russ turns his words around.
Right.
He's like, he's so evil he doesn't even recognize evil, is how he sees Ivan, right?
Right. Well, the thing, that scene is interesting because Ivan sort of says, you know, Russ, you are the problem. Your police force is putting people in prison who are not actually evil. They're just your idea of what evil should look like. So, that was such an interesting, writing Ivan was such an interesting experiment for me.
The police don't come off very well.
No.
In this book.
No.
In many ways, one of them being, you know, cover-ups of things that happened, and they seem kind of incompetent, but there seems to be an undercurrent of corruption there as well.
Yes, and this was all very imagined, of course, and part of the reason that Broomsville is a fictional town, because in doing research for this, I spoke to many wise and very helpful police officers who sort of said, you know, this would never happen unless this was a horribly corrupt system. And I said, well, I'll make up a horribly corrupt system. Yeah.
Was Was that a challenge to have a fictional town, but also giving a shout out to real places? I mean, Longmont gets a shout out, and you know that it's very much situated in northern Colorado. So did you always have to have an idea in your head, okay, this is where this is? I nearly have an imaginary map, and this is where this particular town is.
Yeah, I had a general idea. I imagine it's somewhere near exit 235, right? But I really wanted it to be a fictional town because I didn't want to be stuck in the confines of a real town. And this town, Broomsville, is much smaller than any of the towns that are actually on the Front Range. And I really wanted an insular, like, you know, kind of claustrophobic community that doesn't exist. But I wanted it to be clear where it was and sort of what the culture was like around that town. So that's why the real towns are also thrown in.
In some ways, it almost feels nostalgic. Like, it's set in 2005, but the size of the town feels like something you might have found here 40 or 50 years ago.
Right.
You know, and kind of the small police force. And yeah, the police, like Maeve says, they don't come off looking good. In fact, I got to about halfway through the book and I thought, you know, no one really seems to be actively trying to figure out who did the murder. And so I thought about it and I came up with the right answer. I'm not going to give it away on the air. And I think Maeve did too. It's, you know, it's, you know, with some competence, it seems like they could have figured it out. And yet that's not how the book plays out.
Right. To be honest, I really struggled with that as a writer. I was so excited to be telling the story of these characters' lives that I forgot that I had to be telling a murder mystery in a lot of ways. And you can probably tell in some parts that, you know, I don't, as a writer, I don't care that much about the investigative details. But you have to give the reader something to hold on to all the way through. So in that sense, I pushed through.
So in that sense, you said that mm-hmm. you did talk to some cops, mm-hmm. some nice cops.
Yes.
And did you try to get some background on the procedure? Mm-hmm. What happens when somebody is killed? And that series of events then that take place afterwards?
Yes, I did some research. I did some research very late in the process about this. Actually, it was after the book had sold to Simon & Schuster, and it was my first editorial letter from my editor. And she said, you know, I don't think this is how police systems work. Have you talked to a police officer? And I said, no, I have not. And so I had a series of phone calls after that, and I had to go back and rewrite everything. So next time I will do the research first is what I learned.
Do you just pick up the phone and call the nearest police station? I mean, how do you even go about that?
I had a couple of friends from Fort Collins whose parents were police officers, so they were very kind and helpful.
I want you to read one more passage, if you could. Jade. Jade really, like I said earlier, is the most visceral character. She gets angry. She has a lot to deal with. But she's the one who kind of holds the book together. It might be Cameron's book, but it's Jade that holds, I think, the story together and holds Cameron together.
And at the end, I think Russ says, you're the hero of this whole story. And I thought that was something I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And then I was so glad somebody actually said it to her.
I was glad to be able to give Jade a redemptive arc and allow her to find the power within herself. And you're right, she is the glue of the story. But she's very angsty, and she has trouble being vulnerable. So I'm going to read this passage of hers that is also very angsty. So this is from Jade's voice. This is how it feels to be a stutter. You're walking down the street and the night hasn't settled yet. It doesn't know what it wants to be. You've lived on this street your entire life. Your family hates you because you're an asshole. You genuinely enjoy being an asshole. This is why you have no friends except the homeless guy who lives behind the library. People like him push you too deep into yourself. You sink this way often, and there are things you can do temporarily to soothe your mind. Turn on new music, cut your bangs in the bathtub, pick at old scabs. But you'll still itch. You itch constantly, because even when you think you might be happy, these truths bubble up to prove you wrong. You're fat, you're angry. In a different world, you could be blonde or kind or friendly, or all of the above. When you slept, you could look like a porcelain doll. But this is not a different world, this is your world, and you have to find a way to deal with such irony. You walk past the Hayeses, the Thorntons, the Hansons. The night is clear. The neighborhood smells clean. The rum churns hot against your ribs. Dashboard Confessional is blasting in your headphones, and you're wishing you could live inside the aching lyrics, inside the guitar's streak, that violent voice box. You want to know what Cameron sees when he walks down this street under the forgiving cover of night. What he finds so fascinating. You want to know how he can stand in one spot for so long with the explicit knowledge that his wanting will never be returned. How he stands with his wanting on the lawn for hours, and how he retreats home with it, unable to stash it away. Your feet are so heavy on pavement, you take up too much space. You want to hear the ocean because you never have before.
That is author Dania Kukavka reading from her new book, her first book, Girl in Snow. It is a murder mystery, but so much more than that, set in a fictitious northern Colorado town from the perspective of three different characters. And Dania has been our guest on the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Thank you.
Thank you.
As we always do at the end of each book club edition, we announce the next month's selection that we're inviting readers to read along with us. This time in September, we're hoping that you will join us in reading Akhil Sharma's book, A Life of Adventure and Delight.
Yeah, we're very excited to get Akhil Sharma. His last novel, Family Life, was New York Times top 10 book of the year when it came out. And this is a book of short stories. But one of the most exciting things is I think we're going to be doing this live, recording it live at the Jaipur Literature Festival on September 16th in the library. I think what he does with his short stories are usually about Indians immigrating to the United States. Not every one of them is like that. I've read about three or four of them in The New Yorker. And he's really great at creating characters and creating situations that immediately hook you in. You're a page into the story and you're at the point where you can't give up on it.
We'll read along with us Akhil Sharma, his latest book, A Life of Adventure and Delight, and come along to the Jaipur Literature Festival happening at the Boulder Public Library downtown. And we'll be doing that taping on September 16th. And we're also going to be talking to a lot of authors during that festival weekend, and that'll all be on the podcast. And a reminder, we're going to have a further conversation with our guest, Dania Kukavka, at After Hours at the Book Club, which is a podcast edition you can find at on iTunes or anywhere else you get your podcasts. In the meantime, Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Thanks so much for listening to The Book Club.